Please be seated. All right, we have two more cases on our 130 docket, and since neither party has pursued a motion to recuse, we will continue with our original panel on case number 2, RSI versus CTC Transportation. If Ms. Spezak will please announce counsel. Yes.
Thank you. Good afternoon.
Afternoon.
Unlike the case before ours, there's no one who hit anyone in this case. It was only a truck carrying construction equipment that hit a bridge, and that's what we're here about today. This was a very interesting matter from one perspective because there's very little written about it in Texas jurisprudence. But from the other perspective, it's a very simple matter, because it's something which is well known in the insurance industry when you study cases from other jurisdictions and when you look at learned treatises on the concept of coinsurance. I was embarrassed when I got this case because I never heard of the concept, and I had been representing insurance companies for 15 years on first party matters. I contacted a colleague of mine up in this area, Beth Bradley, who does a lot of this, and Ms. Bradley tutored me and showed me the way. And what we have here with this concept is you had CTC who tried to shortchange Essex by buying less insurance on cargo it was hauling than the value of the cargo. And CTC had been buying policies from Essex for 5 years. All five policies contained an identical co-insurance provision. For reasons unknown, possibly because the trial court was like me, did not understand this concept, and I, like other counsel, learned something from Mr. Baumgartner in trial, that when the trial judge said, this concerns me, it's a penalty provision, CTC rode that penalty horse all the way to judgment. And coinsurance is a penalty, and the trial court was concerned about that. And the trial court found two bases for finding that the coinsurance policy should be ignored. In conclusion of law number 2, the trial court found it to be ambiguous. In conclusion of law number 3, the trial court found that in addition to being ambiguous, it wrote it was an unjustified penalty that is void and unenforceable. I want to start with the second point, and this is actually the first time I've ever charted new water in front of a panel after writing a brief, but the penalty argument that CTC made and the penalty finding by the trial court is absolutely 180 degrees in opposite of Texas statutory law. There is a provision in the insurance code. The current provision is section codified as 2002.005, but the provision that was in effect before the recodification of 2007 was Article 5.38. And this provision of the insurance code it applies only to fire insurance and allied lines. And the legislature saw fit to say that when you have a private dwelling, a home, a residence, and you insure it for a fire or a windstorm or property loss, the legislature said that no company subject to that provision, no fire or property company providing any policy that the insured shall be liable as a co-insurer. The next sentence down of that article says, however, co-insurance clauses and provisions may be inserted in policies written upon other products in the process of marketing, shipping, storing, or manufacturing. We had a product, a commodity, a piece of construction equipment in shipping that was damaged, and we had a cargo policy to cover it. The legislature has specifically recognized that we can do that, Essex can do that.
And didn't you say that this clause, or one virtually just like this one, had been in the prior five policies?
Yes, Justice Livingston. In fact, it was four prior policies.
Four, okay.
Not only did we say that, but at trial the party so stipulated
that
language that was there in the prior policies. And in fact, the facts of this case, as you may have read in the record, was comprised almost exclusively of stipulations to streamline the trial process. Not only is there a statutory provision stating we can have this coinsurance clause, that statutory provision then, I think, by even if it didn't specifically state you can have it on products and shipping, by the legislature limiting it to being a prohibition only on fire policies on private residents would say you can have it elsewhere. Texas jurisprudence as well, I counted no less than five cases. The one going back to, it was the first one, 1899, a Texas appellate court case, Pennsylvania Fire Insurance versus Moore, 51 Southwest 878, said coinsurance clauses are acceptable in Texas because it puts a burden on an insured to watch his property, to keep it properly insured. And then there's other cases. There's one at 78 Southwest 2nd, 1026. In fact, Fort Worth had one, 275 Southwest 2nd, 833, a 1955 case, automobile insurance versus Hartford. And so Texas jurisprudence is replete with references to coinsurance cases, just like everyone else, every other jurisdiction. There's an interesting ALR article on coinsurance, which they cite. It's ALR 43LR 3rd 566, and it says that coinsurance clauses are acceptable unless there's a statutory prohibition. They were acceptable at common law. Now let's switch to the second basis, which was conclusion of law number two, which rolled into three, the alleged ambiguity. We have rules of construction for insurance policies like all other contracts. You know, there's an old saying that rules are made to be broken. If that saying is true, it's applicable here because the trial court broke every rule of construction in this case. The first argument that's made is that there was a term that was not in bold in the coinsurance provision of vehicle. It wasn't in bold, therefore it creates an ambiguity. Well, let's look at it. First have to look at statutory construction. And CTC cites in its brief on page 11 that one primary rule of it is you must presume the parties to the contract intended for every clause to have some effect. But what did the trial court do in this case? Totally ignored the coinsurance provision. Is that reasonable because the word vehicle was not in bold, or is what Essex is contending reasonable? What we're contending is, first, if you look at the term vehicle, it appears right in front of the phrase described in the declarations. You go to the declarations, there's 14 vehicles. This is similar to the case of Evergreen National versus Tan et al. I urge the court to read this case. It's at 111 Southwest 3rd, 669. In that case, there was property being referred to, and the dispute was whether it was just Suite A in this shopping center with a particular address, or was it the whole shopping center? And it was a dispute about if property is within 100 feet of the premises described in the declarations. And one side was arguing, well, the premises is the whole shopping center. But the court held, no, you would be totally ignoring the phrase described in the declarations if you did that. You have to go to the declarations. You have to jump back and look at it. I'll submit to this court that it's more reasonable to say the term vehicle is modified by the phrase described in the declarations because the parties intend that every word should have some meaning. You have to look at all the provisions in the contract. In Balderon, the Texas Supreme Court case, which both sides, I think, has cited, I know CTC has, it makes a comment that if you have alternative interpretations, if one is unreasonable, and I'll submit to you, totally ignoring this coinsurance provision is unreasonable, you can't consider that alternative. You know, where the tie goes to the runner, where they say if it's ambiguous and you have two reasonable interpretations, you go with the insured's interpretation. I agree, but the insured's interpretation in this case is unreasonable, patently unreasonable. Next, even if you look at the word that's not in bold, that's not the triggering word for the coinsurance provision, because right after it talks about vehicle being in bold, and then it talks about the respective limits applicable under this policy bear to the total value of the cargo on the bold word vehicle, whether damaged or not. So it's that second word which triggers the coverage. Finally, what you had here is you had a very simple provision which has been applied throughout jurisprudence for at least 110 years in Texas, and you have the trial judge totally ignoring it because it's allegedly ambiguous. One of the ambiguity arguments which was raised by CTC in its brief, I'd indicate to this court, should not consider because there was no finding of fact made by the trial court nor a conclusion of law upon which based this alleged finding of fact, or is they're alleging that the application was ambiguous because in one part it said that the maximum value of the insurance sought by CTC was $500,000, that the maximum amount of cargo on any trailer would be $500,000, the average value would be $195,000, and that was in box 17. But then he jumps down and says in box 24, which it had identical numbers, the $195,000 average max value and the $500,000 max value is identical. How could that be ambiguous if it's identical? Even if it was, the trial court did not enter a finding of fact saying that created an ambiguity, nor did it base its conclusion of law on that finding. So I don't think that should be before this court. Another interesting issue which they brought up was that for some reason they're contending that because of the wording of the coinsurance provision, it makes meaningless the limit of loss section. In the policy, it gives you choices on how do you determine calculation of a loss. What is the limit? It said, one, you can use the amount agreed upon by the parties in the bill of lading. We had the bill of lading at the trial court, and everyone agreed there was no amount stated. CTC's president said there's no agreed amount, so we get rid of that. Oh, by the way, it's the lesser of these three things. The second one was the market value of the property. Well, that's obviously a total loss situation, and this wasn't. And then the third was the cost of repair, and that's what CTC has argued, that this convert insurance provision makes meaningless the cost of repair, that you can never get to it. But the only way you never get to that is if you violate the coinsurance provision. Because if you took out the right amount of insurance for the cargo you're hauling, if CTC never hauled cargo in excess of $500,000 like they represented to Essex in the application of insurance, you would never trigger the coinsurance provision because CTC would have come to its agent, paid the lower premium for the lower coverage, and if it hauled cargo with that value, it's never triggered because the coinsurance provision, as stated in, I think it was great, the Templeton case where it cites, I cited on page 10 of my brief, that it cites Couch on insurance, it cites CJS, it cites Cooley's briefs on insurance, all these large treatises, and it says, from its very nature, such provision can only take effect where the actual loss is a partial, less than the amount of the insurance. So that's when you use it, and you only use it if you have an insured such as CTC who wants to save a buck and wants to underinsure its property and doesn't want to insure its property for the proper amount. And the reasons are obvious. If you buy less insurance, you're paying less money for it. And CTC thought that it could get away with this. Finally,
So you're saying that if CTC had bought coverage, had purchased coverage with a limit of loss of or a liability of $700,000, then on this claim, Essex would have paid 100%.
That is correct. Okay. And in fact, Mr. Clark, in the record, in the testimony, or actually Mr. Lindemuth, his insurance agent, said on other occasions when they haul cargo in excess of this, they buy that gap filler. And Mr. Lindemuth testified, I told this to Mr. Clark. He knew he would have to pay more than the deductible if he hauled cargo in excess of the value stated in the policy. There was going to be some sort of penalty. He said, I didn't use the word penalty, but I told him there was going to be having to pay more money if there was damage. I see I got a yellow light. I'll probably get a red light in about 5 or 10 seconds. So I'll turn it over to counsel for CTC, and if rebuttal is necessary, I'll take my last 5 minutes. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Baumgartner.
Please the court, counsel. You know, in dealing with insurance policies, and I have, like my other opponent here, have dealt with them for a good number of years, unfortunately more than he has. Not that that means anything, it's just a fact. But the issue of, well, golly gee whiz, fellas, this one is in caps and that one isn't, and it's boldface, and what does that mean? The site that counsel referred you to at page 11 winds up with, everybody's in agreement that this is the governing law, we give the terms our plain, ordinary, and generally accepted meaning, unless the instrument shows that the parties use them in a technical or different sense. Well, guess what, fans? Vehicle is defined in this policy. We'll get to it in just a minute. But if you would, turn to Appendix Exhibit 1, which is the Essex Insurance Company truck cargo proposal, and this 500, 500, or 500 that you just heard counsel say is identical to what's at box 24. Let's look at box 17. Limit requested, 500,000. Per vehicle, 500,000. Per disaster, 1 million. Average exposure per vehicle, 195,000. Maximum exposure per vehicle, $500,000. And Mr. Lindemoon did say and testify that in the event the loss was in excess of $500,000, that Mr. Clark and CTC would have to pay the difference or have other insurance that covered it. Interestingly, if you get into this policy, and the entire policy is before the court, you know, there are specific findings of fact made, conclusions of law made, but all the evidence is before the court. There is a provision at page, I believe it's 30, of this policy that requires the insured to get written consent from the insurer to buy additional insurance. So if Mr. Clark wanted to get insurance above $500,000, this was a $700,000 crane, he would have to get written permission from the insurance company to get that kind of coverage. But if you look at the record, what Mr. Clark told Mr. Lindemoon to get was exactly what this says. Maximum exposure per vehicle of $500,000. It had been $500,000 a year before. It had been $300,000 the 2 years before that. And that is because in 30 years of trucking, Mr. Clark had never had a damage to any kind of thing that he was hauling in excess of $500,000. Never. Now, this isn't go out and save me premiums, ladies and gentlemen. This is go out and get me a policy that gives me the first $500,000 of coverage, less the 1% deductible. That's what I want. That's what the front side of the application says. Maximum exposure, $500,000. On the back side, in box 24, you come in with construction equipment, percent of total 100%, average value $195,000. But rather than maximum exposure per vehicle, we have maximum value. That is of the cargo. That changes this policy, if that's the way the policy is written. And lo and behold, that is how this policy is written. If you will turn to page 2 of the application, which is Exhibit 2 on the appendix, you will find the declarations. You will find in the declarations that the policy covers cargo only while physically carried on the following boldface vehicles, or if indicated in paragraph 1 above, mobile homes, yakety-yak, attached to the following boldface vehicles. You continue to read the policy. It says that boldface words have special meanings. If you'll turn over to page 7 of the policy, boldface vehicle is defined. And also, if the little box down here at the bottom of the description of all the vehicles is checked, that results in blanket coverage on all boldface vehicles operated by the insurer, including detached trailers. Well, on the, well, Mr. Clark wanted the first $500,000 of coverage, less the deductible. Mr. Lindemann goes out, finds an application for a policy, thinks that's what he's got. He explains to Mr. Clark, now you understand, Dan, that if the thing is more than $500,000 and it's almost a total loss or a total loss, you're going to have to pay the difference. Yeah, I understand that. That's fine with me. Doesn't have anything to do with premiums at all. If you get over here, you've got the limit of the loss being $500,000, which is what Mr. Clark wanted. Everything on the insuring agreements, on the perils, on the exclusions, on the deductible, is consistent with the policy that CTC thought it had purchased. The only thing that isn't is the 100% coinsurance charge at page 6 of the policy. And it says, the company shall in no event be liable under this policy with respect to insured liability for loss or damage to cargo on any non-boldface vehicle. In this policy, a non-boldface vehicle is a non-insured vehicle. So, the company's not going to be liable for anything that happens on a non-insured vehicle or at any terminal described in the declarations for a greater percentage of loss or damage in the respective limits applicable under the policy bears to the total value of the cargo on the insured vehicle or at the insured terminal at the time of loss or damage, whether damaged or not. Now I ask you, what does cargo on an uninsured vehicle, whether it's damaged or not, have to do with Mr. Clark's transportation business? And I will submit to you absolutely nothing.
Mr. Baumgartner.
Yes, sir.
You're looking at a definition of vehicle.
Yes, sir.
Page 7, which is essentially defining that a vehicle means a power unit or a tractor, on which you have a specific amount of insurance on page 1 of the declaration.
Yes, sir.
Of $500,000.
Yes, sir.
What other issue is there about bold vehicle, other than to identify the tractor unit upon which is listed on the declaration and the amount of insurance on that tractor?
It identifies an insured vehicle.
As opposed to an uninsured vehicle.
Correct.
And here we had an insured vehicle, so what was uninsured didn't have any difference in this case, did it?
Sure it did, because that's what this provision is applicable to. It's applicable to non-boldface cargo on any non-boldface vehicle. That isn't an insured vehicle, period.
Well, the boldface in the coinsurance includes, in the last phrase, bears to the total cargo value of the bears to the total value of the cargo on the vehicle or at the terminal at the time of loss.
All right. That is an insured vehicle.
Yeah, isn't that talking about the tractor that had the trailer that had the construction crane on it that ran into the bridge?
Yes.
Well, then the co-insurance applies to the vehicle that was involved in this transaction, doesn't it?
Not if the policy that you bought and had been told that you bought gave you coverage for the first $500,000 or as stated in the application for the, just a minute, I'll get it. Maximum exposure. The maximum exposure for Essex was $500,000. But even though that's their maximum exposure, they say no because the value of the cargo is in excess of $500,000. You need to get insurance on the other $200,000. Mr. Clark didn't want that insurance. He wanted the first $500,000, less than 1% premium. That's what he thought he got with this policy. And when you get over to this co-insurance provision, when you're dealing with what it, in the policy, the vehicle that's not bolted isn't an insured vehicle. So you're starting out with it's not liable under the policy with respect to the insured liability for loss or damage to cargo on any non-insured vehicle or at any non-insured terminal described in the declarations. The declarations don't deal with any non-insured anything. It deals specifically with the defined boldface vehicle and the defined boldface terminal. And then you get into, for a greater percentage of loss or damage than the respective limits applicable under the policy bears to the total value of the cargo. Now we're on an insured vehicle at an insured terminal at the time of loss, whether it's damaged or not. Well, if it's not damaged, where's the loss? It just didn't make any sense. It didn't make any sense to the judge, the trial court, and that's why he found it to be ambiguous. That's why he found it to be a non-disclosed penalty that he didn't think that this insured needed to put up with, at least.
And I have a question.
Excuse me.
I have a question. If the in the co-insurance provision, if the term, the first time it's used, vehicle was bolded, and the term terminal was bolded when it's used the first time in that sentence, then would you think that the provision was ambiguous?
I hate to say yes, but yes. I wouldn't think it would be ambiguous.
You would not think
it? I would not think it would.
Okay. Okay. Thank you.
I'd like to say I would think it would, but I don't. But the policy here, where you're dealing with the special meaning and the definitions, the limit of loss at 4 describes the $500,000 as defined in the insuring agreement. The deductible at 1% value of the load. That's fine with everybody. The other 6, 7, 8 Roman numerals are not applicable. But the declarations and the guts of the insuring agreements are. And because in this policy, it is further ambiguous because none of the Arabic numbers referred to in the policy exist in the policy. For example, under Roman numeral 1, this policy covers liability of the insured as set forth in the insuring agreement, Arabic 1, for loss or damage, etc. There is no Arabic 1 in this policy. There is no Arabic 2 in this policy. And you can read it till you're cross-eyed, and it just doesn't happen. This is a policy that was put together on a wish and a promise, for lack of a better description, that didn't state what the insurance company thought it stated and didn't state what CTC thought it stated. And under those circumstances, given an ambiguity, the Supreme Court mandates that the insured's interpretation covers it. Thank you.
Yes. Proceed.
Mr. Baumgartner?
Yes, sir.
I know your time's expired, but I'd like to ask you if you could tell me where in the policy does it state that a non-bowled vehicle is an uninsured vehicle?
I don't think it does.
Thank you, sir.
I think it defines bowl-faced vehicle as an insured vehicle. And if it's not insured.
It doesn't say that. It's just a matter that when you use the definition of vehicle as an insured vehicle.
Correct.
Then by implication, a non-bowled vehicle means something that's not insured.
That is correct.
Thank you, sir.
May I proceed?
Yes.
Thank you.
Just to pick up where counsel had left off about the Arabic numbers 1 and 2 not being found anywhere. The first point is, again, this is something that the trial court did not base its finding on, just like the application issue. Nowhere will you find a finding of fact or conclusion of law based upon this argument. If you read the policy where counsel has pointed out on the first page of the declarations, it says, as set forth in insuring agreement, Arabic 1. Well, you go to the next page, it has a heading, insuring agreement, and it makes reference to the very first paragraph. It talks about cargo being insured. And then it says caused by the perils listed in paragraph 2. Go to the second paragraph, it's entitled perils. So it's the job of the court to make sense, to construe every provision, and see if it can be construed reasonably. That's a fairly reasonable construction. If you look under the heading insuring agreement, you go to the first paragraph, it matches up to the DEX page. It refers to paragraph 2, perils. That's entitled perils. So I think that's a reasonable conclusion. What I really need to touch on, though, is there's been a lot of talk about what Mr. Clark and his agent talked about, what they discussed. The evidence was at trial in the record on page, I think it was 43, where Mr. Lindemoon says, I am Mr. Clark's agent. I'm not Essex agent. In fact, RSI was Essex agent. You can see that on the policy. It says the Essex broker. It says CTC at its Essex agency, RSI Inc. So, and then we asked Mr. Lindemood on pages 49 and 50 of the court record, okay, since Mr. Clark's asking you about all this stuff, did you go to Essex and talk to him about coinsurance, whether it's included or not included on this policy? Well, he says that there was no discussions, quote, about the inclusion or non-inclusion of a coinsurance provision in any of the policies. Well, obviously, someone dropped the ball. It wasn't Essex. It was Mr. Lindemoon. And Mr. Lindemoon should have known, and Mr. Clark knew, or at least had constructive knowledge, for 4 years before this particular policy was in existence, it contained a coinsurance provision. In fact, there was evidence in the record that he had other claims, and none of them hit the coinsurance, but there were some proof of loss forms submitted in the record, and each one of those proof of loss forms that was submitted referenced a coinsurance provision as well, even though it didn't apply. It said coinsurance 100%. It's a standard form in the industry. That's in our record. And so what you have here is you have, on the one hand, CTC is asking this court to strain to get an interpretation of something that is not a reasonable interpretation. The term in, you know, this bold versus non-bold, as the Supreme Court has told us, it's up to the three of you to look at this policy, and if you can find, if there's a reasonable interpretation, such as one Essex is espousing, and an unreasonable one, CTC, totally ignore it like the trial court did, Baldoran mandates that you don't go with the unreasonable interpretation. I'll submit the policy was not ambiguous. It was clear. The term vehicle, although not in bold, was meaningless, but it said the vehicles in the declarations. There were the 14 in the declarations. Go with the common sense reading of the policy. You have to read the whole policy, and the parties must intend that every word should be given meaning. And there's a lot of cases out there that talk about if courts are going to just ignore provisions, that as a matter of law is an unreasonable thing to do, and that's what CTC is doing. So based upon Balderon, they have an unreasonable interpretation. You cannot consider it. You consider Essex reasonable interpretation, and this court needs to reverse and really render that that the judgment be modified for the $35,000 and change, I think is the number which Essex has always attempted to pay but could not because of the material breach of CTC, which was in writing that they were not going to pay their coinsurance, they were not going to pay their the deductible with that. They only wanted to pay a deductible, and because of that, Essex was deprived of the benefit of settling this claim because the ultimate owner of the equipment would not take our money. That's in the record. They said, we will not take it, we will not sign a release until you give us everything. CTC materially breached it, and therefore they should not be able to benefit by their breach. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Wilkowski. Thank you, Mr. Baumgartner. We appreciate your arguments today and your briefing. Your case is submitted.